how do luxury companies get to the point that those products are so valuable?
It intrigues me, actually, because there are two kind of mindsets in the world, which is if anything's very good, it should be made abundant and everybody should have it. The French tend to have a mindset that anything that's any good has to be unbelievably scarce. There will always be some very rich people who wish to practice costly singling.
What are your thoughts on the ethics of marketing?
There's a kind of game which apparently happens in luxury goods stores where you get extremely attractive women to actually be slightly rude to the customers. And then the older, slightly less attractive women are so keen to make their point that they buy something really expensive.
That's funny.
It is just really, really interesting when you understand the extent to which, of course, human behavior is mediated by the imagined opinions of others.
Rory Sutherland, welcome to my podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come on. I have so many questions about marketing for you and psychology. I think this could be a very interesting conversation, hopefully.
I hope so. Yes, I think it's, to be honest, I think the fundamental observation that goes through all my books, my writing, is fundamentally quite banal. What is interesting to me is that it comes as so much as a surprise to most people reading it. The idea that actually, you know, at some fundamental level, perception is reality, in that we behave in response to what we perceive rather than what is factually or objectively accurate. And therefore, you know, there are certain aspects of problem solving in human behavior where some marketing-led approach is inescapable. That seems to be basically self-evident, but it comes as a complete surprise to people in fields as diverse as economics or politics, who see it as their obvious duty to improve objective reality with complete disregard for how the actual change or the input is perceived, which seems to be fundamentally odd.
Yes, this is true. Do you think there are personality traits that play into the role of how good people are naturally at marketing?
Well, I think there's an interesting one, which is there's a fundamental distinction, which is I don't think you're a very good marketer if you're highly dogmatic. If you insist on having a one-size-fits-all dogma or I suppose, yeah, you might almost call it sort of, you know, a litany or religion that explains everything, okay? And you're unhappy to consider contextual variation in things, then you're not going to be a good marketer. And it worries me to an extent that what our education system seems to do is it selects for people who can win arguments rather than solve problems. And it strikes me that the act of solving problems is fundamentally messier, more experimental, more creative, and less certain than the toolkit you require to win an argument, which is effectively construct an artificial model, win the argument for the model, and then walk away satisfied, regardless of how applicable that solution might be in reality. And so it does bother me a little bit because it strikes me that we probably have a governmental class, an administrative class in business, which has been selected for its ability to look coherent and to maintain logical consistency rather than the rather more important question of whether you solve problems or not in reality.
You guys may or may not know, I launched a hangover supplement called After Party, which you can get at fullerhealth.com, linked below in the comments. It works by breaking down acetaldehyde, which is responsible for poisoning you after drinking. Nobody likes waking up with the feeling of hangover with nausea, headaches, and other symptoms. And dihydromyrisetin, main ingredient, is backed by peer-reviewed studies. Not that I normally believe most studies, but these are legit studies done on rats. All the studies are linked on my website at fullerhealth.com if you want to nerd out, but it helps reduce alcohol damage. Obviously, this isn't an ad to encourage you to drink. It's not good for you. Period. I don't even think the small amounts that they say are good for you are good for you. But if you do have the occasional glasses of wine or beer, or for me, vodka soda, this can go a long way in preventing damage to your overall health and making you more productive the next day, which is what I'm about. can't take any days off work if I want to get ahead in life. It literally reduces my hangovers by about 80% so I can work normally. Let me know what you think. There's a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can try them even if you're skeptical. No strings attached. I will give you your money back if you don't like them, because you'll like them. Go to fullerhealth.com, code MP for 15% off, linked in the comments. Enjoy the rest of this episode. So do you think this is something somebody can be taught in university? Like, is going to get a marketing degree, is that something people can do and then be successful?
Interesting question. I mean, some large part of it, I think, is, if not innate, and it may not be innate at all, but it is a kind of tacit skill in that it's not completely teachable, that it requires, if you like, a refinement of instinct rather than what you might call hard teaching. It's one of those many, in fact, most of human behavior is actually driven by tacit learned experience, which isn't necessarily explainable or teachable. A great example is reversing if you're reversing a semi into a narrow gate or opening. Now, a lorry driver, a truck driver is going to be better at that than the professor of engineering at Yale, okay?
Yeah.
That's because it's really much more a kind of learned instinctive skill. In the words of someone on Clarkson's farm, I can't tell you how to do it. You just have to know. And I think, a large part of marketing is probably tacit. It involves, as I said, the refinement of certain instinctive qualities rather than something. And in fact, I would argue that people who insist on having a process and an absolutely rigid procedure before they can start work on anything probably aren't very good marketers. That's always the worry. If you ever have a problem and the first thing the person wants to know are costs and timings, you're probably not cut out for this business. And it probably, this is connected to, it's not exclusively about creativity and other skills like humor. Again, humor being, something incredibly fantastic as a skill.
Yeah.
And it's connected to that, but there's a very interesting experiment in John Cleese's excellent book, which is called Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. He advances some evidence that they take a group of architects who are highly prized for their creativity and imagination, and they compare them to a group of architects in their working methods who have been nominated by their peers anonymously as being workaday, extraordinarily uncreative, generally uninteresting architects. And one of the patterns in their working behavior, which completely bifurcated between the two groups, was that the uncreative architects started work straight away. And the creative architects kind of had a weird fallow period where, to put it one way, they understood that the art of coming up with an idea was not something you can force. And what they were doing, in a sense, was waiting to get lucky. They were waiting for inspiration. Strike, something of that kind.
Okay, that's interesting.
Because we have a world which is obsessed with kind of what you might call nominal productivity, which kind of prizes being busy at all costs. And one of the things that, the great John Lennon quote, time spent doing nothing is very rarely wasted. And I think he knew whereof he spoke, in the sense that some degree of discretionary, uninterrupted time is probably essential to any really significant kind of mental progress. Now, don't get me wrong, in a Fordist production line, when you want to do exactly the same thing time after time after time, you can narrow it down to an optimal process. I don't think you can do that with any kind of creative act. The best you can do is just increase the odds of getting lucky. There's a great, great book on this, by the way, by Rick Rubin, which is called The Creative Act, A Way of Being. I was on Rick's podcast a few weeks ago and was generally extremely enthused by reading his book beforehand. And it's a very, very good take on, quite a lot of the behavior that I think is involved in creativity is, in a way, it's, as I said, it's not only non-logical, it's sometimes paradoxical. And by the way, there are lots of fields of activity that work this way. In fact, I would argue that the majority of human decision-making has to work this way. Because what we consider to be science where you have all the information you need to arrive at a single right answer, where the relations between the different variables are all set in stone, and where the laws cannot change, okay, that's a very, very narrow subset of problem solving. Yeah. There are special cases. Okay, we know the relationship between air pressure, the boiling point of water, and the amount of energy required to heat water to boiling point. And so you can provide an exact calculation there, partly because all the data is commensurable. You know the relationship between all the data. It's exact, and it doesn't, and it's eternal. You know, I assume so. Anyway, as far as we know, you know, there's a Newtonian component to the world where the laws seem to be pretty much written in stone.
Yeah.
It's real world problems and nothing of that kind. And yet what we tend to do is we pretend they are. And Hayek used to talk about scientism, which is the use of methodologies and patterns of thought derived from the hard and physical sciences, and then their application for reasons of credibility or indeed winning an argument to fields in which they're entirely inappropriate. And I think that's an interesting point, because an awful lot of human effort nowadays seems to be dedicated to making things look scientific, even yes. though that probably isn't the habit of thought you need to solve the problem in the first place.
Yes,
I think the concept of scientism is interesting because it, you know, there isn't really, there are certain words which always bother me because there's a vocabulary problem in that the opposite of rational is irrational, which is automatically assumed to be a term of opprobrium. You are being completely irrational, okay?
Yeah.
I.e. stupid or foolish, okay? So there isn't really a proper term for hyper-rational, for example. There isn't really a term of criticism that applies to things that look rational but really aren't. And there isn't really a term of criticism for things, well, I mean, Hayek used scientism, but then what's the noun you create from that? Scientistic is the adjective, I guess. What are you if you practice that? Scientist? I don't know. But it's a very useful term, but it never took off. And that really is the appearance of looking scientific in effectively solving problems which don't really submit to the same conditions in which you can practice the scientific method. Medicine's kind of interesting because it's, is it a science or is it a craft? Well, it's kind of a mixture.
Yeah. Okay. That's fascinating. You talked a little bit about luck. So I've got a bit of experience with marketing and we're building an app, which I told you about offline, Peterson Academy for online courses. And I realized, I think a couple of years ago, that I couldn't sit, because I'm pretty work oriented. So I like to sit down and solve problems. And I realized for developing something new, I did have to kind of wait. And sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of the night, yes, and go, oh, here's the idea finally. But there was no point in sitting down and forcing it because it just didn't work. I just had to wait. And sometimes it would take months and I'd be like, oh, I'll figure it out. Something will click eventually and I'll figure it out. So I get what you're saying about waiting, but you mentioned luck.
Yeah.
Is there any way to increase that or kind of hone those skills?
Yeah, I think there are patterns of behavior you can adopt and there are mindsets you can adopt, which is almost the act of distracting yourself or listening to the unconscious voice. I mean, a very boring one, which is commonly advanced, is the overnight test. You know, if you think about something, you sleep on it, and the following morning, you know, maybe you have a further bout of inspiration, or maybe you realize the idea was kind of dumb all along.
Yeah.
There are interesting patterns of decision-making. The one I'm very fond of, mentioned by Herodotus, is that the ancient Persians, when they had to debate any matter of import, they debated it twice, once when sober and once when drunk. And it was only when they agreed in both states that they actually adopted the action. So if it didn't appeal to them when drunk, and in other words, if it didn't in a sense have an emotional appeal to them, and it also, so it had to meet two tests. In the same way, I suppose, the jury system is interesting in Anglo-Saxon law, in that you have to convince not only legal experts that there is a case to answer, but you have to convince a representative body of people that what you're saying is just fundamentally believable and indeed reasonable. But I had a friend who was on jury where the person was in strictly legal terms guilty of the crime for which they were charged. But the jury agreed that given the provocation, their behavior was entirely understandable. And they basically let them off. That's not supposed to work like that. But it's similar to that Persian question where you look at the same thing in two different modes, context, settings, or whatever. And it's a, by the way, it's a great disadvantage which creativity suffers from. So I always make the point that there is in any kind of institutional setting, there's this asymmetry where creative people have to present their ideas to rational people for approval, but it doesn't really happen the other way around. You don't get a bunch of accountants going, well, we've come to the conclusion that it's 3.7 million, but before we actually make that decision or write the check, we're going to share ideas with some really wacky people to see if they've got an alternative idea. You don't get engineers going, well, we want to make the train faster. What about you? What would you do? Okay.
Yeah.
Because within any kind of rational, self-contained model of the world, it's effectively self-sustaining. Whereas creativity isn't self-sustaining. You've always got to win some battle somewhere else before you're allowed to act. And it seems to me that that asymmetry is kind of problematic. And that, I mean, if you want to get really deep in this, I don't know whether you or indeed your dad have ever met Ian McGilchrist, the author of The Master and His Emissary.
Yeah, definitely.
That's, if you like, the vastly more philosophical and neuroscientific take on what I'm saying, that there's a natural balance between effectively left hemisphere, right hemisphere, modes of seeing the world in which in many, many settings, probably because of the need to win arguments, by the way, that's one reason, the left hemisphere view of the world artificially is allowed to predominate.
Huh.
That would be McGilchrist's take on it.
Yeah, and that's definitely true.
I'd also argue that there's a fundamental problem with good ideas, which is that they're often late to the party. In that the rational, what appears rational and consistent has an instantaneous appeal, whereas the better idea, first of all, takes time to be accepted, but also takes time to be generated in many cases. You know, there are cases in point where, you know, I was given a brief and, you know, in the advertising world, and being candid, if this happens, I failed completely. And then 6 months later, inspiration struck. I go, oh God, why the hell didn't I think of that then? But the simple fact is I didn't, because there's a kind of probabilistic. I'll tell you a little story, which I shared with Rick Rubin as well, which was, I've got a friend who runs a business called Assure.io, which I jokingly call Airbnb, because it's effectively a home rental for homes where people intend to work. So every home you rent will be kitted out with two retina screens, two very good desks, two ergonomic chairs, an espresso machine, and it'll have shit hot Wi-Fi and probably electric car charging. Okay.
That's so
it's
cool.
It's going to be Airbnb for a particular application. And I said, look, I can't think of anything that will help you advertise your product, but if I get lucky, I'll let you know. Okay. And about 6 months after I was aware of this business, I was staying in a hotel room with my wife. And it was actually my wife's observation, not mine. Well, she said, why is it, which is a brilliant, brilliant piece of observation, which had never occurred to me. Why is it that hotels have this sexist idea that only one party in the room will want to use a desk? Okay.
Yeah.
So there's this fundamental sexism in hotel rooms, which is there's a chap signing million-dollar checks sitting at the kind of Napoleonic scale desk. Whereas meanwhile, his lady wife is in the bathroom kind of, you know, powdering her face or, you know, putting on a polka dot bow, you know. This is about the 1950s conception of what a partnership is like. And funnily enough, I mean, there's a reason my wife noticed this, because I think I was hogging the desk and she was forced to sprawl on some totally inappropriate item of furniture while trying to type. And I said, thank you, because you've just solved the problem for Assure. And the basic question is, which is a very good question, how can hotel rooms have two wash basins and only one desk? I mean, you spend a hell of a lot longer typing than you do cleaning your teeth. But for some weird reason, they've decided that two wash basins are absolute essential. Okay. But one desk is absolutely fine. And so that's the kind of
interesting
example
observation.
Where I say, you know, in many cases, you've just got to wait to get lucky. And the reason is often, I think, there are several reasons. Some ideas arise through a very difficult form of observation, which is the dog that doesn't bark in the night. In other words, you have to notice the absence. You must know the Sherlock Holmes story. I hope you were versed in the... what Holmes notices is that the theft of a racehorse is probably an inside job because the dog didn't bark. Now, that is, if you like, not a data point. It's actually the absence of an expected data point, which is harder to notice. Often, by the way, ideas that generate interesting things arrive anecdotally. They're surprisingly tangential or irrelevant. That the inspiration you get is, in a sense, is not something that arises when you're actively looking for it. It's almost, in some ways, creative ideas are almost the act of distracting yourself. I do have a kind of favored thing, which is that I notice that you're more likely to have an idea or an inspiration when you're in a liminal point. So in other words, if you go from doing one thing to another, just to make that point, Archimedes didn't have the idea sitting in the bath, as is commonly believed. He had the idea when he got into the bath. And, you know, one of the things I quite like about working from home and flexible working is that when you have 10 minutes to spare at home, you go and put the dishwasher on. You do something entirely different. Okay. And weirdly, it's at the moment when you flip from one mode of activity to another that inspiration is more likely to strike, I think. So, you know, I think there are tools. I think you can improve the odds. I think you can, to borrow a kind of Nassim Taleb phrase, you can increase your surface area exposure to possible upside optionality. Okay. I think you can do that, but you can't necessarily force it.
Okay, I like that. I feel like I've noticed the same thing. I have, like in my life, I have a number of different projects going on, and I need a number of different projects because if I only have one, I'm bored and it just tortures me. So I have way too many things going on. So I can work on one and say, okay, I'm done. I'm tapped out here and move on to the other one and then move on to the other one. Is there like for people who are inclined to go into marketing, do you think there's an optimal number of projects they could work on at the same time? They'd be switching tasks?
It's interesting because one of the reasons for the existence of, for example, the advertising agency as an entity is that there's a certain sort of person who would find it painful to work on one thing all the time. And so there's a certain kind of mindset which thrives on variety, which an agency provides, which working in-house may not. Generally, I'd say working in marketing in-house will provide you with a hell of a lot more variety than becoming an actuary or something. I would recommend it for people of a particular mindset if you can cope with and thrive on and even relish a certain degree of messy. If you're obsessed with having a universal framework which answers all questions, go and become an economist or something dangerous like that instead. You know, but if you actually are happy with the fact that correct answers are scale and context dependent, and that psychology is a deeply perverse thing where the opposite of a good idea can be another good idea, if you're comfortable with that kind of thing, then I highly recommend it. What worries me a little bit is I've spent 30 years in advertising. I think advertising is actually probably a bit more important than people think, and it's highly entertaining and very enjoyable. What started to worry me is what's significant about an advertising agency, and to some extent marketing as well in general, is there are very, very few modes of employment in which this type of thinking is encouraged, rewarded, or tolerated. Okay. So I once jokingly said that the great thing about working in an advertising agency is the one job where you can make a daft suggestion and still get promoted. Because something that's interesting, eccentric, counterintuitive, or odd is prized in that atmosphere and encouraged and rewarded in a way that it's often punished anywhere else. You know, in many other forms of employment, you'd be seen as, you know, fundamentally whimsical and not a safe pair of hands. Now, you know, to echo McGilchrist, what worries me, I know him quite well, actually, he's a great guy. And he's actually, interestingly, quite interested in advertising for this reason, in that there are worryingly few areas of activity where that kind of creative thought is properly rewarded or encouraged, I think. Because in many ways, you know, there's a, you know, any good creative person will have some very strange attributes. They don't really have a sense of proportion because they know that inspiration is just as likely to come from something trivial as something big. You know, noticing the two words sound similar, okay, which is, you know, is seemingly irrelevant, can be a breakthrough in that kind of problem solving. And it does worry me that, if you like, that politics doesn't really have a creative department, that, you know, that actually a sensible, healthy organization would encourage a degree of what you might call at least creative dissent from the mainstream narrative. And you know, I jokingly said, look, if I'd been in charge of an investment bank in 2007, okay, I would have been fired long beforehand as an appalling person to run an investment bank. But the one thing I would have done is I would have been immune from the financial crisis because in my outer office, I would have employed sort of three Marxists or Austrian school economists or anybody who effectively had a counterpoint to what was an over-dominant kind of narrative of effectively a self-confirming narrative of how the economy works. And so, you know, I think there is a, you know, there's a natural kind of perversity. There's a lack of sense of proportion in creative people. There's kind of whimsicality. There's a reluctance to get started. All those things, I think, are a virtue in a creative setting, but they're not a great career move in most forms of employment.
Yeah, this is definitely true. I think I was probably just fortunate choosing. I had like a normal job that was very rational. And then I kind of did the creative things on the side until they grew enough to overtake, which I'm happy about. I'm grateful for. I have a question that's completely unrelated to what we were talking about. I've always wondered, how do luxury companies get to the point, like say Hermes, for example, how do they get to the point that those products are so valuable? Are they all doing something similar?
I mean, there are rules you can't break. I mean, one of the things which, of course, is interesting is that many of them are privately owned. There's a very interesting thing, which is that I think there are two kind of mindsets in the world, which is the Anglo-Saxon one, which you find in North America, which is if anything's very good, it should be made abundant and everybody should have it, which is why the United States produced Coke, okay? You know, as Warhol said, all the Cokes are the same and all the Cokes are good. And the president of the United States can't get a better Coke than the bum on the corner of the street. Okay. And for a long time, particularly now, the French tend to have a mindset that anything that's any good has to be unbelievably scarce. Okay.
Ah, okay.
And one of the things that both, snobby French bastards combined with a privately owned company have as an advantage is that they resist the temptation to overproduce. Now, it also helps if you've been doing it for 100 years, if you have an extraordinary degree of heritage and authenticity. It also requires remarkable creative talent over long periods. I'm not suggesting that it's easy. But it is a kind of fascinating fact that of the most valuable companies in the world, and certainly the ones that are most profitable in terms of margins, if you discount one or two pharmaceutical firms and Apple, the rest of them tend to be luxury goods businesses. Now, it's also not a bad business to be in one respect, okay? In that whatever happens in the world economy, and this applies, by the way, even under communism, okay? Whatever happens politically, there will always be some very rich people who wish to practice costly singling.
Costly singling?
Oh, right. It's a concept from biology, originally from an Israeli biologist called Amos Zahavi, to explain things like the peacock's tail, which is that effectively a costly signal is one which is a reliable indicator of fitness, because you couldn't afford to carry this decorative baggage around on your back if you weren't a pretty fit peacock to begin with. Okay. Elk's antlers are another example. In other words, they're things that actually grow. The guy to read here is a brilliant econ naturalist called Robert H. Frank, who's written a book called The Darwin Economy. But a large part of human consumption is actually positional. It's not really about utility at all. It's about your relative position and status. And of course, certain things demonstrate status very reliably, because they've certain things demonstrate wealth very well, because unless you were rich, you couldn't afford to do them, you know. And so, you know, you might argue that sporting ability is a form of costly signal, because it's a reliable indicator of your fitness. And cool. So that's as distinct from cheap talk, which is merely an unsubstantiated claim. A costly signal is kind of a proof point. Now, you know, we use this kind of mechanism all the time. I guarantee, for example, that you have never left a FedEx or UPS envelope unopened on your desk for 3 days. Okay? Because your inference is someone spent $20 to send me something. Therefore, I can infer from that that it's something of reasonable importance. Okay. So, you know, when you send out a wedding invitation, you don't do it by email. You know, there are all these kind of ways in which we signal through discretionary effort, discretionary expenditure, discretionary attention to detail, you know, discretionary perfectionism, you know, that things that are difficult to do just carry more informational freight than things that are easy to do.
Yes.
But to some extent, good manners is really the display of discretionary effort, you know. And so costly signaling is something which, you know, it exists in the animal world, and she exists in flowers, interestingly, in the sense that bees tend to be more attracted to plants with larger flowers on the grounds that you wouldn't bother spending all that money advertising your wares if you didn't have quite a lot of nectar. Because if you did false advertising, where you had very big petals but no nectar, you wouldn't get any repeat business. And so your investment in flowers would not, in petals, would not be repaid. And so hummingbirds certainly, I think, use this as an inference point, which is the more you spend on advertising, in this case petals, the more likely it is you have something worthwhile. And so that, you know, that's another form of reliable, costly signal. But luxury goods really cater for people's positional urges. And, you know, one of the things are, you know, those bags are not only rare and expensive, by the way, if you want to buy a Kelly bag, they won't even sell you one until you've established your bona fides with the luxury goods retailer by buying a whole load of other products which can't be resold at a profit. So if you try and just go in and buy one, I think it was an incident with Oprah where she complained about sort of racist treatment from a luxury goods bag store in Switzerland, okay? I'm not sure it was actually because, I mean, any person working in one of those stores would learn fairly quickly, I would have thought, not to discriminate by race, because there are very, very rich people of all ethnicities. You know, whatever you think, there are undoubtedly forms of ethnic inequality and wealth at the aggregate level, but there are very, very rich people in all ethnic groups. And I suspect what that was genuinely something like that going on, which is you make the product difficult to buy. There's a kind of game which apparently happens in luxury goods stores where you get extremely attractive women to actually be slightly rude to the customers. And then the older, slightly less attractive women are so keen to make their point that they buy something really expensive in a kind of pretty woman kind of gesture. You know, you've dissed me. To now humiliate you, bizarrely, I'm going to buy half the contents of the shop.
Yeah, wow.
So, you know, this is the kind of weird gamesmanship. This is why I always say marketing, the opposite of a good idea can be another good idea, because in many fields, really good, friendly customer service is a great thing to recommend. In other fields, weirdly, it pays to be bizarrely disdainful and disrespectful of your target audience. Okay. So, this is why it's so fascinating, because context changes perception. I mean, effectively, our behavior is driven by our feelings. Our feelings are driven by our perception. And our perception is driven by context. And so if you change the context in which someone sees the same thing, they perceive it and emotionally respond completely differently. Now, I'll give you a lovely example of this, which I only learned today, which is there was a Dominican and a Jesuit who both wanted to know the answer to the question, secretly hoping it would be yes, can I smoke when I'm praying? And the Dominican comes back and says, I asked my abbot or whoever it was, okay, can I smoke when I'm praying? And he said, no. He said, oh, mine's fine with it, the Jesuit replied. He said, what did you ask? I said, can I smoke when I'm praying? I was told no. He said, you asked the wrong question. He said, you should have asked the question, can I pray when I'm smoking? He's fine with that. So that's an example of how contextual reframing completely changes, okay, our response.
That's funny. I didn't think, I mean, I know now that you've said it, but there's definitely a pattern between American brands and mass marketing and European brands and very niche marketing, making products difficult to buy. That is definitely a European thing.
I mean, it's interesting that American luxury brands like Tumi, for example, pretend not to be American in a funny kind of way in some cases.
Is that an American brand? I didn't know that. I assumed that was Italian or something.
Finnish. Yeah, it's actually American. But there's a general pattern where the French in anything, foodstuffs, whatever, they believe that scarcity and quality, wine, obviously, are basically intimately connected. Whereas the Americans have much more of a Fordist mentality, which is, if this is any good, we should produce loads of it. That's partly the difference of having a market of 350 million people, you know, and so on. But the clever thing, of course, about being a luxury goods maker is whatever the economy does, there will always be absurdly rich people who will want these markers. Now, there's a lot of talk. I don't know if you're a fan of Succession.
I love that show. The dialogue is just beautiful.
Loved it. Now I'm not a fashionista, as you've probably guessed from just looking at me, but apparently there's a lot of kind of Max Mara and stuff like that that's worn by a kind of billionaire class, which wants to signal quiet wealth, and those kind of, you know, those kind of cashmere zip neck things that Logan Roy used to wear, all that stuff. And so, you know, you do need multiple brands depending on what the person's trying to do. I made a very mischievous comment the other day when I said, all these brands like, you know, Prada, okay, and Max Mara, I said, they're not really luxury brands because they're tasteful. I said, you know, which suggests that you still care what other people think. I said, the only real luxury brand to me is just Versace, where you just go, I'm minted and I don't care who knows it. And there's an element to me which says that, are you genuinely really, really rich and successful if you're still agonizing about other people's appreciation of your own taste? Or is there actually a certain freedom that comes with vulgarity? You know, I always think everybody would have a hot tub deep down, wouldn't they? Okay. The only obstacle to having a hot tub is middle class angst about, you know, taste and discernment and all, you know, and all that. Actually, being middle class is a massive disadvantage because, of course, you're massively worried about what other people think of you, which I suppose both very posh people and working class people are far freer to pursue their own enjoyment without endless concern for the opinion of others. Everybody wants a hot tub, you know.
Yeah, they should.
Yeah. You know, it intrigues me, actually, because, you know, the obstacles, you know, one of the things, I always say that marketing often makes a mistake. It asks, how can we persuade people to do this? And I go, no, before you start doing that, look at what are the obstacles to doing it and see if you can remove any of them. And that it strikes me that the removal of negatives is actually probably more potent in terms of behavioral change than heaping on kind of claims of positives. And it's right, you know, there are really interesting things that emerge when you look at it backwards. So every time I meet Coke, I always make this point that Coke has this Coke has this utterly magical property, which is you can ask for it absolutely everywhere without it seeming weird. And if they haven't got it, it's their fault, not yours. Okay. Now, when you think about how rare that is, that's kind of true of water just about. Okay. But you can go to a Michelin-star restaurant, you can ask for a Diet Coke. You can go to a beach shack in Barbados, you can ask for a Diet Coke.
Yeah.
You can go to an African shanty town, and they've got Diet Coke. And if you ask for it, by the way, there's no possible kind of opprobrium or embarrassment that, you know, comes crossing for it. Now, you know, if you went to a Michelin-star restaurant and asked for a Dr. Pepper, which is, not all that, right? The whole thing is going to be fraught with embarrassment, awkwardness, low expectations, and so on. And so it is just really, really interesting when you understand that the extent to which, of course, human behavior is mediated by the imagined opinions of others. There's a great quote from, I think, Abraham Lincoln, where he made the point, which was also made, by the way, by the same... Who was the guy? You'll know the guy who performed that extraordinary experiment where people pretended to be prisoners and pretended to be tortured.
Stanford? Stanford experiment?
The same academic who did that experiment also did an experiment with his own pupils where he just told them to go on the subway and ask people to give up their seat with no visible disability. And the point of the experiment was not to see how many people gave up their seat. It was the fact that the majority of students came back and just said, I'm sorry, I'm quitting now. I can't stand this anymore. That the act of asking someone for their seat on the subway was just so socially embarrassing, transgressive and weird that they experienced something not other like pain. And Abraham Lincoln's point was, I think, slightly more sort of probably different, 19th century take on this was, if you were asked to walk around your town wearing your wife's bonnet, without being able to explain that it was for a bet or a charity or something like that, you would experience just extraordinary pain. I suppose it's kind of interesting because what these social norms do, and I was talking to David Sloan Wilson the other day, who's an evolutionary biologist, is, of course, when you establish social norms and conventions of that kind, it changes the nature of evolution. So that it doesn't only happen at the individual level. It's not just a matter of individual selection. It becomes a matter of group selection. Because our behavior innately has become conditioned by group dynamics, not by individual self-interest.
Yeah.
So there's quite, I think he's a great proponent. By the way, I'm going to, half my Darwinist friends are going to disown me at this point. But David's a kind of fan of multi-level selection, where he believes that selection and effectively takes place at concentric different levels of both the individual and the, and then the family and then the wider group. And there's a kind of level of cultural selection. I don't know why
Darwinists... That's interesting.
I don't know why Darwinists hate the suggestion that Darwinism might work in multiple ways, but they the gene-centered view seems to sort of predominate anyway.
Interesting. Hey guys, if you're looking for a way to increase longevity, reduce inflammation and brain fog and anxiety, and improve your health, and you're into biohacking and you haven't tried Zoning, you're missing out on what I believe is the easiest way to detox and feel better. Obviously, you can't sauna out bad lifestyle choices, so you still need to monitor what you eat, exercise, etc., but you kind of can. At least it's better than doing nothing. So even a regular person who doesn't care what they eat, of which I have many friends like that, a little bit jealous of them, but they can also benefit from sauning. Boncharge's infrared sauna blanket is what I use when I'm traveling or not at home. It works just like a big infrared sauna. It's built in, but it's portable, easy to clean, and easy to store. They ship worldwide, and if it doesn't meet your expectations, their returns policy has a 30-day trial and a solid 12-month warranty. Go to boncharge.com/MP. Use code MP. You can save 15% off. That's boncharge.com/MP and use code MP for 15% off. Check the link in the comments and description. Enjoy the rest of this episode. What are your thoughts on the ethics of marketing? The more I learn about marketing, the more I realize, well, okay, for instance, this is what happened to my family in the last couple of weeks. So Dad put out his new book, and then a couple of weeks ago, it turns out one of the quotes on the book that was a very positive quote was written by someone who had written this incredibly negative review. And the book, like, it was just a toxic review. And the book publisher had taken two half sentences, melded them together, and put her name on his book. Obviously, she wasn't happy about that. We had no idea that was going on. And when we approached the publisher, they said, oh, we do that for everyone. It's just the norm.
No, I mean, there was a famous case of a London play where the cast effectively just played for the audience, were playing for applause all the time. And it was apparently an absolutely horrible play because the cast were just basically applause hungry. And someone wrote an absolutely damning review, which ended with which basically described it as one long curtain call. And 2 weeks later, above the theatre, one long curtain call was posted along the billboard marquee. Now, undoubtedly, it is absolutely possible to market unethically. It's perfectly possible, I think, to market unethically without being aware you're doing so. I do hope that things like behavioural science make it easier to spot dark patterns, as you might call it. And that's an extraordinary trick. I can't believe they do that for everyone because it seems to me to risk reputational embarrassment on the part of the public.
Well, it certainly did in this case. It didn't go well at all. It was all over the news everywhere. And we're like, we didn't ask for like fake reviews, but apparently it's normal. Like, it's like, that's lying.
It's certainly grotesque misrepresentation. I mean, totally artificial selection of data. I mean, to some extent, of course, all advertising is to some extent a distortion of an already distorted reality, in the sense that advertising comes from the Latin anim advertere, which is to direct someone's attention to. And what you generally do you direct the attention of the viewer or the audience to that aspect of the product in which it has a comparative advantage over its competitors. And by a peculiar quality of psychology, whereas logically we should pay attention to what's important, actually the process works in reverse. We think important what attracts our attention. That certainly explains the news cycle, okay? Because you have this awful problem, I think, in the news cycle where effectively news generates its own news. Now, you know, if you take a case, by the way, I do not condone the kiss of the Spanish FA head at all. I think it was an atrocious act, okay? Right? So I'm not condoning the guy. He obviously must be a very unpleasant guy because the only person who defends him is his own mum, okay? But equally, at the same time, I don't think it warrants the column inches that it currently gets. You know, there's a war in Ukraine, and we're talking about, you know, freeze framing a video to determine. Now, also important, by the way, because there's an interesting question there, which is the only person who can really determine and judge that act is the woman herself, okay? Because there are relationships and contexts in which that is an acceptable thing to do, and cultures, incidentally. It's a bit weird, actually. I don't know how North Americans are reacting to this, because it's more normal to kiss on the lips people with whom you're not romantically engaged in North America, apparently, than it is in Europe.
Oh, my gosh. Supposedly, I can't imagine.
Most extraordinarily, okay, Ronald Reagan kissed the Queen Mother on the lips, okay, when they met. And she was actually horrified because no one had done that since her late husband. But to a Californian of that era, Reagan, well, I venerate, so I'm not having a dig, you know, okay? But to a Californian of that era, that wasn't that weird a thing to do, apparently. I don't know. So there's a whole cultural aspect to it. There's also a relational aspect to it. And so the only person who can really speak meaningfully about that act is the person to whom it was done, because to everybody else, we're really just bringing our own prejudices to the party. So it's quite interesting in that respect, but it certainly doesn't warrant the press attention it's been getting. You know, it's absurd, okay? And so you have this thing where we deem important those things which attract our attention. In other words, it's something that works backwards in a way, you know, that we don't actually pay attention to what's important. We're just as likely to deem important. There's a great line in Citizen Kane where Kane says, make the headline big enough and I'll make the story bigger. that, and actually, by the way, most media bias works that way. It doesn't work. People who are trying to call out media bias always talk about the opinion that is attached to a story. But the greater part of media bias is actually the prominence that's attached to the story. Okay. Now, to put it another way, I think if you'd had three newspapers in collusion, you could have buried Watergate. Okay. You could have reported on Watergate, put it on page five, and everyone would have gone, yeah, they're all at it, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so the greater part of media bias manifests itself in where what is given prominence, not in what opinion is attached to the reporting of events. And you know, I see obvious cases where, you know, there is extraordinary selectivity in which stories to pursue and which to downplay.
That's for sure.
You know, and you know, there are a large number, you know, if you're a middle-aged old bloke like me, there are a large number of stories where you just get, I don't really get this. I mean, you know, I just don't, you know, I don't understand, you know, why is this even a story, you know? But it is interesting because obviously, now this is interesting because there's one way of looking at this, which is it distorts perception, okay? Because by making someone look at something differently, they appraise it differently. Like the Jesuit priest, okay? Yep, it's absolutely fine to pray while you're smoking, okay? And they arrive at a different judgment. But then if you accept that there isn't a single objective right answer to the question of which air fryer should I buy, okay? Right. by the way, one of those extreme cases of this was I nearly bought a Tesla because it had dog mode, okay? So dog mode is where you can leave your dog and stop petter activists smashing your car windows on the assumption that your dog in a car in a car park in Scottsdale, Arizona. When you approach the car, the screen displays a big picture of a dog and says, I am comfortable at a temperature of 72 degrees Fahrenheit. My owner will be back soon. Okay. To stop activists smashing your car window.
Yeah.
Because they assume that if the engine isn't running in the early days of electric cars, people wouldn't have clocked the fact that the air conditioning could work while the car was silent. Now, what was weird is I'd always bought a Tesla for that reason alone. I don't even have a dog. Here's the counterpoint to this, which I think is interesting. Okay. Now, I only discovered this concept a few weeks ago while reading about Bernard de Mandeville, who is the world's most interesting and mischievous economist from, I think, the early 18th century. And he wrote a thing called The Fable of the Bees, which suggested that effectively private vices amalgamated to public goods, that it was actually extravagant self. He was a precursor of Adam Smith in some ways, and you know, was an influence on later economics because he understood that individual self-interest could transmogrify into a collective benefit, effectively. Mm-hmm. And there's this concept called Mandevillian intelligence, which is that the aggregate of lots of different silly people actually adds up to something intelligent. Okay? Look, democracy is a kind of Mandevillian intelligence that you know, that some forms of foolishness cancel out. So, you know, but if you have lots of different people buying a thing for different reasons, at the level of the marketplace, you end up with much better products than if everybody bought a car according to a formula of fuel economy divided by, you know, multiplied by maximum speed, divided by cost or whatever, okay? If you had a single rational way of buying cars, cars would actually be awful because they'd all be optimized for four or five dimensions and they'd end up being really ugly or really dangerous or something else, okay? Because the things we weren't optimizing for would effectively get neglected. The fact that people all choose to buy cars for a different panoply of totally nutty, you know, Americans are kind of keen on the number of cup holders, aren't you? I mean, you're Canadian, I'm sorry, I'll park that one. But North Americans are, you know, seem to be much more interested than Europeans in the number of cup holders and so on.
That's funny.
But when you amalgamate all those different preferences, you arrive at a market which has a kind of collective intelligence, kind of aggregate intelligence, Mandevillian intelligence. Now, what worries me, oddly, is new internet-enabled markets where we all choose the same way, okay? And I talk about My concern is I have a really major concern with property websites, because everybody goes place, number of bedrooms, price, high, low, and then they search, right?
Yeah.
Now, because everybody's actually effectively doing elimination by attribute in the same order, okay, this is going to lead to absolute absurdities in the property market, which it does, by the way, because apparently you can't sell a house for £850,000, okay, because people are either searching 800,000 and up or 900,000 and down, and they won't find you till too late. Or the 900,000 people think you're a bit too cheap and the 800,000 people think you're a bit too expensive. So you don't have a price demand curve. You have a kind of price demand ziggurat in the housing market. But also, architectural quality is ludicrously under priority.
Yes.
Right? Because you end up with a choice of six houses and you buy the least ugly one. Right? Now, my argument is, now there are two websites in the UK. There's the modernhouse.net. There's also Inigo. Inigo sells kind of classically beautiful homes, you know, from Victorian, Georgian, etc. And the modern house is obviously, as it says, the modern house. There's also, by the way, a website in North America called Right on the Market, which simply lists Frank Lloyd Wright homes, which are for sale.
Oh, that's cool.
Woof.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, the interesting thing there is that It's a different approach to the state. What it's doing is it's directing attention to aesthetics rather than location, price, square footage. And it strikes me that those websites are a very necessary corrective, because if we all choose in the same way, the market will become stupid and houses will become uglier.
Yes.
And so now, if you have the modernhouse.net, there is a greater incentive to actually build a fantastic modern piece of architecture, because you actually know you might be able to sell it. Whereas if you go to Rightmove, I don't know what the Canadian equivalent is, you know, moose.com or a okay, but you know, if you go to the Canadian equivalent, okay, effectively, you know, the equivalent of Rightmove, nobody's going to find the likelihood that someone who loves modern architecture finds a modern house is actually that. As I jokingly said, imagine if we bought our lot that way, okay? If we said, I want something 6 feet by 3 and mostly blue with a bit of green, portrait, not landscape, and I wanted to feature 2 cows and a goat, okay? And then your art dealer came out and I said, I've got these 3, okay? Well, in that world, Picassos would be really cheap, right? Because nobody would ever find them. Because nobody's going in and saying, you haven't got a load of prostitutes in Avignon, have you, where they're kind of wearing African masks? No one's ever going to ask for that, okay? So the danger is that the unasked-for component of the product becomes ludicrously devalued and deprioritized.
Yeah.
Whereas a few fairly arbitrary criteria then dominated the decision. So there's another argument I'll make, which is an interesting one. Now, bear in mind, I'm giving pro-marketing and advertising answers. I also have some anti ones. I think the housing market would be much more effective if all real estate agents listed negatives, by the way.
Yeah.
Because if it were mandatory that any major negatives were listed, people like me who didn't care about certain negatives would be able to find a bargain by finding a house next to a pub. You know, to 90% of people, the house being next to a pub is a source of disturbance. I mean, to me, that's a positive boon, okay? Now, you know, the ability to actually navigate the housing market where you look for things which are devalued by other people but are irrelevant to you would be an additional efficiency in the housing market, but instead real estate agents just list the positives. And one exception, Roy Brooks in the 1960s and 70s, who wrote incredibly rude, patronizing reviews of the property he had to sell and then put them in the Sunday Times. It was a completely, you can research him. Brothel in Pimlico is a collection of his various property investments, which are all a list of negatives, effectively. Very, very interesting advertising approach, by the way. But actually, there's another interesting thing which we never mention, which is that competitive capitalism, through serving a load of disparate needs, okay, completely without anyone intending it, creates a form of resilience that you don't get in a control economy. So it prevents, if you like, if a whole industry is optimized around certain things, it acquires vulnerabilities, dependencies, because it's over-optimized for efficiency and therefore under. Now, the very fact that, this is a mischievous suggestion, so bear with me, okay? But if doctors were allowed to choose their own surgical masks, okay, we wouldn't have had a mask shortage, right? And the surgical masks are bought by bureaucrats who have some sort of flaming stupid bureaucratic, SN254 standard 3,
yeah.
Okay? And they're all bought from the same place. And it turned out there was a shortage of the machines, not of the masks, but of the machines that could staple the elastic to the mask.
Oh. Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is, if masks had been a fashion item and some people had gone around with their Kath Kinston floral masks and other people had a Louis Vuitton mask, okay? Now, the mask industry as a whole would be less efficient most of the time, but it would also be a lot more resilient because you'd end up with multiple suppliers effectively serving disparate consumer needs, which, as an unintended byproduct of that activity, actually creates a kind of resilience and ability to adaptability within the market. Anything that's traded as a commodity becomes shit, basically. It just becomes a race to the bottom on a kind of price quality scale. We meet the lowest possible definition of quality, okay, at the lowest possible price. And I don't know what it's like in Canada, but milk was kind of traded this way. Now, the problem is that when you're traded as a commodity, there's no incentive to incentivize because you don't have a brand to which superior quality draws customers. And so the feedback mechanism between quality of experience and repeat purchase doesn't exist. This is why the Soviet Union had this huge problem because why would you make any good bread? Because the only thing you had to bear was the cost of making better bread. There was no material reward in terms of people choosing your bread over somebody else's. And without brands as effectively the unit of selection of product purchase, actually capitalism doesn't really work very well. You don't actually get much innovation.
Huh.
I think we overlooked that. I think we overlooked the central role. And what was interesting in the Soviet Union is they thought brands were un-Marxist and tried to do without them. But they eventually were forced to make factories stamp their identity on the rivers. Because otherwise, if rivers were all bundled together in a central repository, everybody had an incentive to make as many rivets as possible at as shitty a level of quality as they could get away with.
Yeah.
So without that fundamental mechanism as a unit of selection on which, consumer choice and experience operates, You really don't have an economy.
Something you said reminded me of dating apps. So you were talking about the housing market and how people plug in a certain number of values. Yeah. So is that's happening the same way, right? Because it's very difficult to judge something like, you can kind of judge it, but it's hard to judge intelligence, humor, if it's just 6 feet and up.
You're undoubtedly overweighting appearance, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're also overweighting static appearance, by the way, because there are people who are attractive by dint of the way they move as much as how they look. Okay. My wife is very, I find my wife extremely attractive. She's the least photogenic person. It's almost impossible to take a still photo. I mean, because she always like put that up or frown or whatever. And, if I were only presented with still photographic evidence, I think I would have we'd be married for kind of 34 years. No. So undoubtedly, it's not it doesn't really practice sort of Mandevillian intelligence where people have different opportunities to assess your various virtues. And so messy, in some senses, messy decision-making interfaces or processes seem to lead to better collective outcomes over time than decision making that's kind of seems to be neat. Because of course the tragic thing is that when you're looking for a house using that standard place, price, number of bedrooms, etc., okay, you're completely unaware of the things you haven't seen. And what's also interesting about it is talking to real estate agents, or if you're to a real estate agent, they'll say that everybody comes to them with a list of criteria. And they know to discount those criteria because the majority of people end up buying a house which meets few or none, in some cases, of the initial criteria they stipulated, because they fall in love with the house for completely different reasons. And the practice of house buying should be recursive. It shouldn't be a kind of decision-making funnel. And I think it's one of those dangerous things which seems rational while you're doing it, because the stupid element is kept, is effectively hidden from you.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
And in dating, I think it's highly, I think dating apps are highly problematic as a choice architecture question.
Yeah. And it's the way they're designed, really.
Well, I got married in 1989. So as one other person said to me, they said they also got married before dating apps existed. And they said, I feel like I caught the last helicopter out of Saigon.
Yeah. Well, I think it really gives like more psychopathic people an area to thrive, which is just terrifying.
Interesting.
Yeah. My dad's figured the same thing, because you get these, you know, extroverted, narcissistic, attractive people on there, and they get all the attention. And the people who are maybe slightly less attractive, but more attractive in other ways, like humorous, smart, they get less attention. So I don't know how they even manage dating apps.
But I mean, one of the important things is acknowledging that marketing can be undoubtedly pernicious, misleading, that there are dark patterns. One thing behavioral science can do, and one thing marketers should do, by the way, is call it out, because it isn't in the interest of a reputable brand for people to actually discredit. Now, an example of this, okay, is that the whole business of online subscription to publications is such a dark pattern, what Richard Thaler calls a sludge affair, where it's very easy to sign up to the introductory offer. It's very easy for them to suddenly upgrade you to the £9.99 a month full fee for the subscription. That's all very easy. But when it comes to cancelling, you've got to phone a blasted phone line, the number for very deep on the site. Now, what those people are doing when they do that is they are discrediting and destroying the whole business of subscription as a mode by which people might pay for media.
Yep.
Because essentially, you know, I go, to be honest, I wouldn't mind paying $4 a month for this, and I'd pay $4 a month in perpetuity, provided I knew I could cancel on a whim. What these dark patterns have done, I think, is they've actually destroyed the whole charging mechanism, you know. I think, you know, and the fact that this isn't called out and there isn't some sort of kite mark for cancellation that's a promissory method that can, and I think there's legislation going through one, I think it might be the European Parliament, which basically says that cancelling a subscription must be as easy as instigating it.
Good.
And I think there's also an issue, which is that, it's incredibly difficult to cancel a recurring credit card payment by calling your credit card up. Now, this is an interesting one, because I think what you notice is they're quite eager for people to subscribe by credit card, because if you subscribe through a kind of bank standing order, you can just go to your online bank account and cancel them. Okay?
Yeah.
It's incredibly difficult to do the same thing using a credit card. And I would favor legislation where recurring payments on it, on your credit card bill, appear at the top, are listed separately, and where there's a three-click mode of cancelling any of them. And the reason I'm saying that is not because I'm a massive consumer champion. It's because, you know, I think that capitalism, when it discredits itself, harms far more people than it benefits, and that is a kind of, that's a toxic externality, really, from the practice.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's so rampant now. Like, there's distrust in everything now. The news, mainstream media. I mean, I certainly don't trust very many marketing ads I see online that are, you know, somebody's review or somebody's quote. I'm like, that's probably just manufactured. It's really not good for everyone.
Where I'll defend this is working with pretty reputable brands over the last 32 years, I've never been in the room where someone suggests something where I go, yuck. More important, perhaps, I've never been in the room when someone suggests doing something where my mum would have gone, yuck. Okay. Or my wife, who's a clergywoman, would go, no, that's kind of horrible. I have heard stories. There was a case, not an Ogilvy client, nothing to do with me, where someone pointed out that if you change the date at which bank charges were levied, you could drive more people into an overdraft limit, and therefore fine them.
Wow. Okay? Yeah. Okay. That's crooked.
Someone, not a colleague of mine, but someone working in the same industry, was in a room where that was suggested. Now, in defense, I don't think it was implemented, but that was made as a kind of serious suggestion. Now, that's seriously yuck. And it's very interesting because, contrary to what economists think, I mean, economists have kind of created a model of the economy which is kind of morally neutral and completely ahuman, okay? You know, in other words, they've reduced it to a kind of mathematical model of efficiency, which all psychology has basically banished from economics. It's reduced to a kind of artificial Newtonian problem. And as a result, they've kind of bypassed questions like ethics or indeed just perceived fairness. Okay. Very, very interesting. Here's a very interesting thing, if you're interested in this. There's a paper written in 1690 by John Locke, which is called Venditio. And it's on a question which used to absolutely bedevil kind of, actually, the church, okay, the notion of the just price. And he makes a very interesting assertion, which is that to charge what something is worth to you subjectively. So he said, imagine you have a horse, okay? And the horse is really on the open market only worth £3 or £4, but you're very fond of this horse. So you'd be reluctant to part with it for less than £5. It is perfectly ethical for you to demand £5 for the horse because that's the compensation that you would accept to hand over the horse. If, however, someone is absolutely desperate for a horse, he doesn't really explain why, Locke, but let's assume they're desperate to visit a dying relative, okay? And they say, I'll pay you anything you like for your horse. Ethically, you should charge them £5 for the horse because that's what you'd sell it for under other circumstances. If, however, you take advantage of their perceived distress and ask them for £25, knowing that that's what they would pay in extremis, that's unethical pricing. And it's a very, very interesting distinction because I think as human beings, that's how we see it. That charging a reasonable amount of money for something when the person is effectively free to take it or leave it, we regard as basically fair. Taking advantage of another's misfortune to profit.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is that Walmart, effectively, I don't know if the people at Walmart read John Locke or not, okay? But Walmart, very interestingly, when you have a hurricane or when you have a massive snowfall, they do not increase the prices of shovels.
Okay.
And they don't increase the prices of nails and bits of wood that you bang on your windows. Instead, what they have is they have a kind of hurricane prediction center, which ships enormous quantities of snow shovels to the areas where they're required, and they're then sold at the effectively the just price. Okay. And Walmart knows what economists don't know, which is that if you gouge customers and exploit their predicament, they're not your customers anymore, because we react to that as humans, not as economists do, by going, well, naturally there's an imbalance in supply and demand, so we must, you know, I would expect to pay $50 for a plastic snow shovel. That's how an economist would think was a perfectly reasonable solution to the problem. Most non-economists don't think that's fair. As Richard Thaler said about ski resort pricing, basically, if you gouge them at Christmas, they don't come back in spring. And so in the attempt to create this kind of reductionist economics, a whole facet of things that basically make us human and were probably essential in the environmental, in the evolutionary environment for actually our functioning as a social species, have been completely neglected. And of course, the role of reputation is interesting too, because, you know, a very large part of economic success is that down to trust. In other words, you know, do people trust you to fulfill your promises? Okay. And of course, economics again has frozen that out of the equation by assuming complete trust, no information asymmetry, perfect information. Okay. And it achieves a kind of mathematical neatness at the price of making assumptions which are utterly ridiculous. And literally assuming conditions that never pertain in the real world. And that strikes me as a, you know, pretty, given the influence of the discipline, that strikes me as a fairly horrific thing to do.
Yeah.
Because you only need your model to deviate from reality in very small ways for the whole model to become worthless. But we seem to have created a world where people's attachment to their models of the world, their allegiance to a particular way of thinking, is somehow tied up with their identity, which is a, it's a terrible, and you see it, by the way, on the right with neoliberal economics, you see it on the left with wokery. But the unwillingness to actually pay, to provide some degree of mental hospitality to ideas which might cause you to revise your particular expectations or your belief set strikes me as very, very weird and comparatively a bit recent, really. I mean, it's an interesting question as to, maybe there have always been aspects of this. There have always been kind of bipartisan tendencies in politics. But it does seem to have gotten a bit worse.
I think it's gotten worse. Not that I have vast amounts of experience over vast periods of time, but that reminds me of the university system. Part of the reason we're doing this Peterson Academy project is because the university system's really bothered me morally, with how much it's charging for a degree that doesn't necessarily lead you to a job you want. And in the US, like, I'm from Canada and it's less insane there, but then the US, it's astronomical.
I've got friends at Canadian universities. Now, what's happened with particularly the Ivy League? Okay. Now think of it like this. Okay. That if you want to talk about luxury goods, as we talked earlier about Hermes and Louis Vuitton and so forth, the greatest luxury goods manufacturers of the lot are the American Ivy League universities, which maintain scarcity despite the fact that technology means that actually the teaching they provide need no longer be scarce.
Yeah.
They're really real estate businesses with a pedagogical sideline. But they also exploit an incredible kind of path dependency in terms of the career paths of people who want to go to work for Goldman Sachs or whatever. I don't know why you want to do that, but people seem to want to do that. Okay, now let me explain. There's a really weird thing that happens in the London property market. Okay, it's the most depressing thing you can do is to be a very, very high-end kitchen fitter in central London. And the reason is you're brought in, okay, to install a £120,000 kitchen in a £5 million house, okay? And the reason you're installing that kitchen is to sell the house, right? Because the house has to look immaculate, because the people looking around the house are, you know, probably Russian crooks who've honey-tracked the local nomenclature, selling them a bloody, you know, aluminium smelting works for £7.50. They're a bunch of crooks, probably, but they're demanding of perfection, and they just wouldn't buy a house if the kitchen was a bit manky. Now, so you have to install a £120,000 kitchen to sell the house to the Russian oligarch and his mistress. Okay. But here's the thing. The second they buy the house, they rip the kitchen out and replace it with one of their own. Okay? So apparently it's unbelievably depressing because you have to install this kitchen to an extraordinary level of anal perfection. And then you know that 6 weeks later, you'll be called in to trash the kitchen and replace it with a slightly different one because Ludmilla didn't actually like green or something, right?
Yeah.
Now, in some ways, there's an analogy there, which is the qualification you get at a university very rarely translates into the actual job you do. Obviously not true of medicine, law, and a few other disciplines, okay? What you have to do is to jump through this prior hoop at enormous expense to prove your employability and to make yourself saleable, even though 4 years in, Goldman Sachs don't care what degree you got. I asked someone who wasn't Goldman Sachs, or, you know, at what point in your career? Now, they said the value of my double first in maths from Cambridge, basically in my employment, had a half-life. You know, it probably never dips down to complete irrelevance. It's something, you know, a bit like radioactive decay. But they said basically five years into my job, everybody wanted to know what I'd done, who I'd worked for, you know, how I'd acquitted myself. And, oh, yes, by the way, you've got a degree, okay? But at the time you first get accepted, and this is where the path dependency comes in, that degree is all they've got to go on. So it's exactly like the kitchen. It's done for display purposes, not for its long-term residual value. Because, you know, what you learned at university largely becomes irrelevant. You know, within a very short time of you starting work, it becomes less and less relevant. But it's necessary to make the sale, not to improve the house. And it strikes me that education has become a little bit like that, which is actually the way it should. So we have at Ogilvy a program called The Pipe, which is specifically designed to be a non-graduate recruitment program, because we think that the obsession with graduate recruitment is effectively, at the collective level, spurning 50% of the population who may have very, very great talents which just don't manifest themselves in academic ways. But there are very, very bright people in advertising who, if you give them something theoretical to do, they'll lose interest immediately. But if you give them a real-world problem, they manifest, displays of genius, you know. There's certain people who just hate theoretical shit, you know. And those people are not very well treated by the academic proxy metric of your intellectual capability. By the way, the way I'd argue it, okay, is that academic ability is a one-way indicator, okay? If you're very good academically, you're probably quite bright, okay? If you're not very good academically, it does not mean you are not bright. Now, just to give an analogy, which is a clear thing which everybody understands, chess is like that, okay? If you're a really good chess player, in some respect, you're quite clever, okay? But it would be monstrously unfair to say that bad chess players are stupid, okay? My brother's an astrophysicist. He's shit at chess. He's not as shit as I am. I do cryptic crosswords. I do cryptic crosswords till the cows come home. I just don't understand why you'd want to play chess. You know, I mean, you know, I think of, you know, virtually anything I'd rather do. But this is the interesting thing. It's a one-way proxy measure, which works in one direction but doesn't really work in the other. So discounting people who have poorer qualifications is not necessarily a safe decision. But then what happens is we offer these people a job. Now, we don't prevent people who've got a degree from applying to the course. That would be silly. We just say that this is a mode of entry into Ogilvy where you can go from there to being chief executive if you're talented enough, okay? There's that, you know, we don't have any qualification barriers once you're employed. And so what happens is we offer a job to someone who has got a degree. And they say, I'm really uncomfortable at accepting this. And you say, well, it's an entry-level job in advertising, for God's sake. You know, they're Oxbridge graduates who fail to get that. You know, what the hell are you complaining about? Okay. And they say, because I've just spent £27,000 getting a degree. And if I then go on to get a job that doesn't require a degree, I'll feel I've wasted my money.
Yeah.
I go, it's not supposed to work like that. It should be. Thanks to the 3 years I spent at the University of blah, I was able to improve my thinking and cognitive styles and decision-making ability to such an extent that I could impress the people at Ogilvy who wanted to give me a job. That's how it should work.
Exactly.
But instead, it's I paid 27 grand for some parchment. And if the job I get doesn't require the parchment, I've been done. That's education as a positional good. It's not education as an absolute good. It's not human capital at all. It's just being used as a mechanism for lazy sortition by, you know, the people who do the recruitment, who are probably the people who are mostly to blame. You know, those people who go 2-1 and above, we only, you know, employ people from these five universities. I mean, those are the people who are really to blame because they've made it possible for effectively universities to profit from their lazy decision making.
I didn't consider that.
My God, they profit. I mean, if you want a bloody business that absolutely coins it, an American university is the thing to add. Yeah, I mean, Louis Vuitton can't even touch that.
Wild. Well, that was interesting.
There's a Brian Kaplan book called The Case Against Education, which is emphatically worth reading. There are a few other people who are... there's also an interesting thing, which is that it may be a misrepresentation. By the way, complete meritocracy may be a mistake anyway, because you don't go to university to be surrounded by a homogeneous group of similarly nerdy people. So there are all sorts of tough questions to be asked about this. One suggestion, by the way, was that, you know, actually the top 20% of Ivy places should be allocated on pure meritocracy, and the other 80% should be by lot. Okay. Which is kind of interesting. But we're in danger of creating a kind of, you know, effectively an arms race. And I think it's the guy who's the philosopher at Harvard, who's called Michael Sandel, who describes many of his pupils as wounded winners. In other words, they have actually succeeded, but the price they've had to pay to get there has had some, you know, deleterious effects. And hyper-competition is bad, by the way. Competition is good. Competition where, you know, broadly speaking, the terms of success are quite broad, and where you can outwit the opposition through creative thinking, okay? That kind of competition is very healthy. The kind of competition which is effectively the Hunger Games type of competition is actually bad, because actually the overall price paid is greater than the prize won. If you include the people who fail alongside it, you ultimately say, look, we're actually exacting a greater price than we are actually conferring a benefit. And there's a very interesting guy called, I think, Fischbach. Check his name. He's a lawyer. But he argues that the whole concept of equality of opportunity is wrong, and that what a society should aspire to offer is diversity of opportunity. In other words, what we've done to produce the illusion of fairness and meritocracy is we have to apply the same criteria to everybody. And when you apply the same criteria to everybody, only some people can win, yeah. And it turns into a kind of Hunger Games death. If you say what we want is a society where lots of people can be successful in lots of different ways, that's not a negative sum game. And it strikes me that concept of broadening opportunity rather than actually fit. The other thing is, you might argue, which is this wonderful talk about, you know, meritocracy and, you know, and equality of opportunity, equality of outcome. All of that presumes a society which is hierarchical. Because when the term meritocracy was coined by Michael Young, later Lord Young, okay, he meant it as a criticism.
Oh.
So meritocracy is often used, particularly in North America, as a term of approbation. It's a meritocracy here.
Yeah.
Okay. Michael Young, who coined the word in England, used it as basically a warning that in many ways it's worse being governed by people who think they deserve to be there. Okay, and believes themselves possessed of superior ability to the people whom they govern, than it is being governed by people who, you know, a kind of slightly random aristocracy who can't help deny the fact that they kind of lucked into the boat.
Oh, yeah. I like that. Keep it humble.
It's interesting.
Interesting.
Well, as Canadian, you understand the value of monarchy, which is that, you know, there is a value to the monarchy, which is precisely that the role is arbitrary.
Yeah.
And it is known to be arbitrary.
That's very true. Yeah. American politics is strange. Even being here is strange. It's very theatrical in a way that I haven't seen.
Where are you in the U.S.?
I'm in the U.S. now. I'm actually in Scottsdale.
Oh, wonderful place.
Yeah.
Have you been to the Hotel Valley Ho? Fantastic mid-century place.
I haven't.
I go and stay there. It's the kind of place where the Rat Pack would engage in, you know. But Scottsdale, the other place you must, which I imagine you have been to, have you been to the Desert Botanical Gardens?
No, not yet.
Right, okay. You got to book that visit. It's one of my favorite places in the whole world because, now bear in mind I'm British, okay? So the reason I love Phoenix, okay, is that if you're British, a desert is magical. Because we live in a country where there's green shit all over the place. All you've got to do is throw some dirt out in the street and something goes green on it. So having your hotel room window and having a cactus, a rock, and some sand is to me absolutely magical. I adore the place. And the Botanical Gardens is a fantastic collection of cactus succulents. And if you go, I'm really plugging this place. If you go at sundown, you also get the hummingbirds coming in to feed off various kind of agave plants or whatever. But it's one of the most enchanting places on the planet. Really, really fabulous.
Okay, I need to check that out.
The other thing you're going to do is the Frank Lloyd Wright tour. So you've got the Grady Gamage Auditorium. You've got a bunch of houses on the outskirts of Scottsdale, which are by Wright. And then, of course, the other one is Taliesin West, which is Wright's. He moved in the winter from Wisconsin, Taliesin, and actually started a kind of architectural school, basically outside Scottsdale, called Taliesin West. And it's fantastic.
That's cool. I had no idea.
Rory Sutton didn't expect me to be the key member of the Arizona Tourist Authority.
I didn't at all. I'm a fan. It's a bit hot right now, but it's either that or winter and
it's
darkness.
Dry heat.
That's what they say. Yeah. Don't worry. It's a dry heat. It's 120, but it's dry. Like you liars. Yeah. Okay, Rory, thank you very much for coming on. That was fascinating.
Absolute pleasure, anytime.
That went way deeper than I was expecting.